Good morning. My name is Tom Bolger, and this is the first meeting of the Pension Subcommittee. Before we start, I'm going to ask Mr. Brown, good to see you again, to give us our safety religious experience.
Great. Thank you, sir. So in the event of an emergency, if the fire alarm goes off, please exit the room and through the doorway to my left or either of the doorways to our right. We'll proceed across Fifth Street using the crosswalk to the building museum, where we will take a census of the folks that are there to make sure that everybody got out safely. Also, if there's an AED needed, there's one out by the guard station near the elevators. This morning's safety contact is pedestrian and bicycle safety. Recently, WMATA held a pedestrian bicycle safety summit in response to the growing number of incidents that have occurred recently. Since January 2015, 27 pedestrians or cyclists have been injured as a result of coming in contact with a WMATA bus. That's nearly two per month. Many of these injuries were the result of the pedestrians or cyclists suddenly coming into the path of the bus without warning, such as jaywalking, walking against a signal, and darting in between parked cars. Moving into the warmer months, we typically see an increase in pedestrian and cyclist traffic in the city. To help keep you safe and ensure our bus operators can see you, please keep the following in mind. Cross the street at designated crosswalk or intersection, and if possible, ensure that you have enough time to cross the street before the signal changes. Increase your visibility at night by carrying a flashlight and wearing reflective clothing. Always walk on the sidewalk when possible, and avoid distractions such as electronic devices that take your attention off the road. That concludes this morning's safety contact.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Let me begin by saying that I want to thank my colleagues for being on the subcommittee with me, and also some of our colleagues that are not on the subcommittee but are sitting in this morning, and I appreciate your attendance. First order of business would be to approve the committee's agenda. If there are no objections, do I hear anyone?
None.
Thank you. So the agenda is approved as presented. Now that the agenda is approved, I'd like to take this opportunity to give a brief introduction and overview of what this new committee is going to be about. The board formed this committee because we recognize that Metro's pension plans represent a significant portion of Metro's budget, and the board would like to have more, a much more active role in the plan's oversight. Mark Pohl, who's with us this morning, will provide the committee with a review of our responsibilities as board members, as the plan sponsor, and the relationship to the pensions, excuse me, pension trustees, sorry. Get this off. Didn't know it was on. Apologize. Next, Al Karem Ali-Dina from Aon will give an overview of the authority's pension plans, actuarial concepts, plan highlights, and key factors impacting our contributions to the pension funds. I think this is going to be very illuminating for all of us. The last time we looked at these pension funds was a long time ago, and I have a number of questions that we exchanged emails about. Finally, the committee will discuss a work program and how we want to conduct business, and I ask my colleagues to help with tailoring that work program for the upcoming year. So with that, Mr. Pohl, could you please go over what our responsibilities and our fiduciary duties are as the plan sponsor, as the board of directors? Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, WMATA currently has five defined benefit plans, which means that there's an annuity payout and one defined contribution plan. As WMATA is a governmental body, those plans are what are called governmental plans and therefore are not subject to either ERISA or the Taft-Hartley Act for collectively bargained plans. That's important when you start looking at what can be done and what can't be done. So that many of the things which you may have read about or dealt with, you know, other than in governmental work, do not apply. The board's obligations, very simply put, deal with the plan's creation, design, and termination of a plan. Now, if it is a collectively bargained plan, you will also have to deal with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. But that is one of the reasons why whenever a plan gets amended, it goes to the board and it doesn't become formally amended until the board passes a resolution, is that is what is called a plan sponsor, you know, right, so that you would have the obligation to amend it, and if you didn't, the plan technically would not be amended. That in and of itself may or may not be a problem depending on the nature of the amendment. In many cases, the Internal Revenue Service requires some of the amendments so that, you know, the board has to act. Otherwise, there'll be other rather undesirable effects on the plan due to its IRS standing. The board also is involved in plan funding. It's done as part of the authority's annual budget. But clearly, you know, the amount of funding, again, subject to collective bargaining agreements, is within the control of the board. They do receive information from the various plan actuaries to help with actually scoping out how much of that money, you know, is needed. It's, again, the representatives from Aon will go for that in more detail. There's also one other piece, the appointment of trustees. Either if it's collectively bargained, there'll be the appointment of the management trustees in a collectively bargained plan, and we've got several of those, most notably the Transit Employees Retirement Plan, representing the 689 employees. The union then appoints their trustees, and you know, the management, usually, you know, the general manager, as currently structured, is the appointing power for all the management trustees. So basically, you know, the way those trustees are appointed, the management side, is usually the recommendation will start out with human resources. It then, under the terms of the policy instruction, goes to the Office of General Counsel for a conflicts check. That way we're not appointing someone who has a direct conflict of interest. Most notably, you wouldn't want, for example, Dennis to serve as a plan trustee, because his trustee obligations very well could interfere with his obligations as the chief financial officer. Next, you know, the trustees have their own roles and responsibilities. Basically, those can be summarized fairly simply. They administer the plan. They are involved in deciding how the plan assets are invested, and they deal with participant disputes. Again, running the plans, you know, is generally handled out of the Office of Benefits, but they actually report to the trustees. And that's handling, you know, making sure you have the right contracts in place, making sure that the meetings are held, that appropriate minutes are kept, that required reports to various service providers are made. Then the trustees also will be involved with the investment. That means they actually will select the investment strategies, whether they're going to use a group of index funds, whether they're going to look for someone to actively manage it, whether, and I know in one of the plans, they actually own real estate. Those decisions are made by the board, the respective boards of trustees, and it's solely within their power. They do have to invest, you know, what is termed to be the prudent expert. That means that it's, you know, you have to have an investment that is prudent, measured by someone who is an expert within that area. So almost all of the plans use, you know, either in-house or outside financial advisors to help. Also they deal with disputes. The staff then handles the day-to-day activities. For fiduciary responsibility, it is based on the Internal Revenue Code and the common law of trusts, so that, you know, most of the rules are going to be Internal Revenue Service rules. And those, you know, can be summarized that you have to act exclusively for the benefit of plan participants and beneficiaries. There is, you know, you do not look at who appointed you and try and help them out. It is exclusively the plan, the participants, and beneficiaries. Now, they are not a guarantor of performance in the market, not in the least, but they do have to be prudent, and they have to use the assets for the exclusive purpose of paying the benefits and the reasonable expenses. They will also have to resolve participant claims if there's a dispute over a pension amount or dealing with divorce settlements. And they administer the plan under its terms and nothing else. At this point, I'll take any questions that the board may have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Paul. Tony, you had your hand up. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, you said you had questions for this side, or you want to wait till?
I'd like to wait till the end. I just wanted to give a big overview of where we stand as a board.
I just have a couple quick questions.
Go ahead.
I didn't want to interrupt you. Of the five plans, it looks like the only one that isn't covered by a union contract is the non-representative 639. Is that correct?
Again, the Securities Clearing Act.
I just want to know how many are not covered by collective bargaining agreements.
Okay. The only plan that is not have either a partial or all collective bargaining is the defined benefit plan covering what we call the non-representative WMATA retirement plan.
That's what I said. Okay. Now,
I believe it's about 1,100 total, including retirees.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. I just wanted to make sure that I understood that part of it. Are each of the five plans managed by professional firms? You mentioned some could use internal advice.
There are two basic roles. You'll have an investment manager,
yeah,
which are all professionals. All the plans go out and do that. You'll have an investment advisor. Now, that has been done for a couple of the plans by the Office of the Treasurer. In other cases, they hire an independent contractors to provide the advice.
So all the plans are managed.
The actual investments are done all by professionals.
Can you get into that?
Yeah.
Okay, so the meat of the agenda, I'm going to ask Mr. Ali Dina to go over what AON, and maybe if you could just start by saying, what AON stands for. I've heard AON a lot, but I'm not familiar with what the acronym stands for, even if it is an acronym.
It actually is, Mr. Chairman, it's not an acronym, so I'm sorry. I don't have a great story to share with you on that. Yeah, but thank you very much for the opportunity to spend some time here. I think my goal here was to maybe spend about 15 minutes covering the material and then open it up for questions and answers, if that's okay. I can make it 10. I definitely can. And it just means we'll be on a little bit of a fast-paced ride, but hopefully we'll all go through. Yeah? Absolutely. The plan highlights? Okay, absolutely. So really, as you said, the objective here today is to, just before we get to the actual five plans and the financial status of the five plans, we thought it would be good to spend just a few minutes to understand how those calculations are done. Okay, so I'm going to try to go through that fairly quickly. If there are questions, stop me and we can ask, okay? So if you maybe go to slide 4, and I think your presentation slide numbers are a little bit different, but 4 is great. Okay, so really, we're going to talk a lot about it. I just want to make sure that we all have an understanding of what is really the ultimate cost of the plan. In essence, if it's a pension plan, you've promised benefits, so you have the cost of paying those benefits. And then, because you're administering this plan, you're required to pay some administrative fees, whether they're professionally managed or internally managed, yeah? So your ultimate cost is that, and there are two ways to fund those costs. The one way is through contributions that are made, either by WMATA or by participants who are participants in the plan and are required to put contributions into the plan. But the bulk of the growth of the assets really comes from investment performance, right? That's sort of where most of the money comes from, okay? So as a committee, if you're going to be looking at some, as you go forward in your analysis, I think you want to keep track of how the assets are performing and what are some of the assumptions that are being made in that area. So something to keep in mind, yeah? But that's the ultimate cost. I just want to make sure that the actual methodology just allocate costs to different periods using different approaches. All right. So if you then go to the next slide real quick, it is a financial model. And in the financial model, there are various inputs that one must make in order to come up with results. The first one, of course, is who is a participant in this plan? Okay, so again, another thing that the committee may want to look at in the future is the dynamics that take place in the change in those employee groups, because managing costs also is based on who are the participants and how long they're in the plan for. What are the benefits in the plan? That's the other way. That's what plan provision stands for. And so, again, that's another question to look at. If you're looking at design elements, that impacts the cost. Because these are plans in which you're putting money into a trust, you want to look at, as I said, the trust assets and what are the value of the assets that are there for the plan, because that determines future required contributions. And then the fourth component there is what I call actuarial assumptions, or, you know, these are the what the financial model uses to value the obligations. Okay? Two key components here. The first is what I will call demographic assumptions. These are when are people going to retire, how long are they going to live to collect a pension benefit, how long are they going to work for WMATA, those kinds of things. But probably the more driving assumptions are the, what are called economic assumptions. What is the interest rate that you're using to value those liabilities? You have a cost of living provision in your plan. What is that assumption? Right? And if you, and because they're pay-related plans, what is sort of the salary scale assumption that you're using? So those are the three key. Again, if the committee's in the future is looking at analyzing results and understanding them better, as we'll see in the plan highlights, there's quite a bit of variation in those assumptions as well. Okay? So if we move along to the next slide, then when you have this information, what do you first, how do you calculate the contribution? Well, in order to calculate the contribution, you need to know what are the obligations of my plan, right? And so I'll give you a simple example here, which will hopefully illustrate what this slide is trying to say. Let's say I have an individual who is 40 years old, and he's been working for WMATA's, one of the plans for 5 years, okay? And he's going to retire at age 65, and he's going to get an annual pension benefit of, let's say, $45,000 a year. So when I'm 65, that person, I'm going to get $45,000 a year. And if I do the actual math, that $45,000 at age 65 is worth roughly about, let's say, $700,000 for this conversation. Yeah? But that's 25 years from now. Okay? And so what's that $700,000? How much do I need to have today for that $700,000? I probably need about $100,000 today. That'll accumulate with my interest assumption of, let's say, about 7% or so to about $700,000 at that point. Okay? So my obligation for that ultimate benefit is $100,000, but that person hasn't accrued all of that benefit, right? He's only been working for 5 years. He's got another 25 years he's going to work. So I got to spread that $100,000 into how much is already accrued and an liability that I have. That's called the accrued liability. And the remaining is what's going to be accrued in the future. Okay? So if you sort of flip over, and I'm going to go a little bit fast here, if you go to the, not this slide, but the next one, please. So this example is what I was trying to describe. The entry age of the individual, because he's been here 5 years, was 35. His current age is 40. His retirement age is 65, right? So today we need $100,000, of which let's just say $10,000 is that accrued liability because for 5 years of service. The remaining 90 is what he's going to earn over the next 25 years. Of that 90, let's say for the sake of discussion here, $5,000 of that will be accrued in the coming year. That component is called the normal cost. So your annual contribution includes at least what the cost is of benefits that people are going to accrue in the coming year. It's called the normal cost, okay? And we'll see that in your plan highlights, okay? But you may not have assets that are backing that full $10,000 that I talked about, that's accrued for that person for 5 years of service. You may only have $8,000 in assets, right? So you're $2,000 short. So you've got to find a way to fund that remaining $2,000 shortfall. That's called an amortization of the unfunded liability. Okay? So your contribution every year is equal to the cost of benefits that are accruing for participants in a given year, normal cost, plus the amortization of that unfunded liability, the liability that you have on the books that you have already accrued minus the assets. Are we good? Yeah? Excellent. So far, before we get into the plan highlights? No? Okay. Excellent. So then let's take a look at the plan highlights. And if you don't mind, it might be easier on your handouts that you have to perhaps look at this, my slide 11 and 12 together, because it's actually all the information is spread over two slides. And sometimes it might be a little bit easier to see everything. But let's start with slide 11. Okay? So as Mark mentioned, five pension plans. Okay? And we've tried to order them sort of in by headcount or even liability. Okay?
For one second. Absolutely. I want to point out to my colleagues that the first line, the valuation date, please note what that date represents. January 1, 2015. Okay? And then you're going to explain that first line and that date and what it means.
Sure. So I don't mind. Actually, that's a great point.
Okay.
So for every actual valuation, it's usually done at the beginning of the plan year.
Okay.
Okay. And so what this is indicating is that the information that we are here sharing with you today has been prepared by your actuaries at these particular dates. All right. So It is dated. I will not disagree with that at all. So right now, your actuaries are working on the more recent valuation. So in the case of Local 689, your actuaries are working on the 1/1/2016 valuation, which I suspect would be available. It's not unreasonable to have it available in about, you know, 4 or 5 months after the start of the plan year, because it takes a while to collect all the information and be able to process it and come up with valuation results. Okay? So you are right that these are dated information, and as the committee goes forward, I think, Mr. Chairman, what you're asking is you probably want to be looking at things that are a little bit more current rather than a lot more dated. Possibly a way to do that in the absence of having up-to-date valuations constantly is to be able to take the most recent valuation and, if I may call it, roll it forward to see what's happening at a particular point in time. So in this case, like if we were meeting here today, it's possible to create a little bit of a dashboard that says as of March 31st, here's what the liabilities would be, here's what really the assets are, and here's sort of what the results look like. If that would be helpful to the committee, some things of that nature can be structured because the valuations are usually just done once a year, and it's completely not unusual to have that happen. Does that help with the answer to the question about the date?
It's very important for everyone to understand that we're dealing with pretty old data. Here we are in mid-April of 2016, yes. And we're looking back almost a year and a third. Mr. Giancone?
Yeah, who's responsible for updating it every year?
It's the plan's actuary, so you have, I think there are two different actuaries that work on the five plans.
So they're tardy.
I don't know if they're, it'd be difficult to say that they're tardy, Mr. Vice Chairman, because, as I said, it's not unusual to have 4 or 5 months.
Well, at least three of them are, because, you know, the others are, the next expectation is this coming July. You know, it says 7/1/2015. So if it's annual, you know, you would expect those two to have updates in July.
Right. So my understanding is that the ones that are dated 1/1/15, we are expecting them in the summer. Mike? So as I said, I mean, it's okay. So the best answer to that question is that normally the plan sponsor. I don't know. So can you turn around a valuation in 10 weeks? You can if you can get the census data. Okay? But you have to be able to get the information as an actuary to be able to do it. So I don't know what expectation was set with the actuaries. That's why I'm trying to hesitate to ask the question. I just don't know what was said and what expectation was set with them.
As a plan sponsor, are we responsible?
Yes. You can put into motion a practice that says we want our results within the first 3 months after the start of the plan year. But then that would require some steps to be taken on your part as well. Yeah?
But also, it's my understanding that this data affects our audit, our ability to have an audit. Jack, I just want to bring that to your attention. But these numbers feed into our ability to be able to do an audit on time that I know you, Mr. Chairman, you've been talking about for quite some time. So, I mean, this is a key component of our audit deadlines. Go ahead, Kevin.
And I think when you say it affects our audit, what is the industry standard that we actually look to? That is, our expectation, and I would say I'm looking at where I am come from, I want to have this information to me before I prepare a budget of proposal. So how do I, what's the industry standard that you see, or is there one?
So I'll tell you my experience with my clients. Generally, it's about 3 to 4 months after the start of the plan year, the valuation results are done. If I may answer it that way, because it'd be hard for me to give you an industry standard. There's no prevalence data out there that I can point to that says industry standard is this much time. But I can just give you my personal experience of what I do with my clients. That would be helpful. Yeah. Other questions?
3 to 4 months. We're past the 3 to 4 months. This yardstick. So go ahead.
Sure. So let me actually just focus on the last column, if that's okay. And that'll be easier, and we can dive into the individual plans if we need. Yes, the total column, please. I'm sorry. Yeah. So in total of the five plans, you have 18,000 participants. The accrued liability, $4.4 billion as of the various different valuation dates. The actual value of assets, that simply means it's the value of the assets in your trust, but it's the investment gains and losses are smooth over different periods. Okay? You have $3.4 billion, so an unfunded liability of roughly about $1 billion on that basis, and a funded ratio of about just under 77%. Okay? I did a similar calculation to say, what if you use the market value of assets instead of the actual value, because a lot of the gains that you've had recently have not been reflected yet. What that does is it would change the asset value of $3.4 billion to about $3.57 billion, and your funded ratio would go up to about 81%, okay, on a market value basis. Sorry, question?
Whatever I'm looking at. Thanks. We have a $1 billion unfunded pension. What does that mean?
It just simply means that the benefits that have been accrued by your participants, if I had, I'm $1 billion short of having assets in the plan to cover the benefits that they've accrued.
Okay. So does that mean like if, like a run on the bank, if everybody wanted their money at once, we'd be $1 billion short? In so, simple, understandable terms, what does it mean?
So it wouldn't be a run on the bank because in a pension plan, you generally retire and get annuity streams.
Right.
A lot of your people are not eligible to retire.
Okay.
So you have enough funds in the bank to be able to pay ongoing benefits.
Okay.
But over time, what it means is that you're going to have to bake up this $1 billion to cover. If we close the plan off today, as you go forward over the next, whatever it is, 20 years or so on, you're going to have to pay this $1 billion.
Okay, and we'd have to pay that out of our operating dollars, is that it?
Just like your normal contributions are paid out of your operating dollars.
Okay. And so $1 billion, is this a problem for us that we have $1 billion, or is it okay? Or, you know, to me it's, you know, when you look at Chicago, California, everybody's going under because of these types of situations. What does this mean for us?
Yeah, and actually,
go ahead,
that,
please.
How is it progressing? Have we been getting worse or better, or, you know, in that funded ratio?
Yeah.
So I think, and I didn't go back and look at your older reports. We can definitely take a look at them. I think that you have been steady because you've been also bringing down your interest rate as well. Okay, so that has an opposite effect. When you start bringing your interest rate down, your liability goes up, but your assets have been doing well enough to be able to maintain your funded ratio. I'll tell you that, comparatively speaking, there's a study that's out there, was done in 2015, of the 100 largest public plans, right? Just so you get a point of reference. And it showed that those plans had a funded ratio of just around what WMATA has, about 75%. So if you're looking at, relatively looking at, is it a problem? That's it's what your funded level is compared to those 100 largest pension plans, public pension plans, you're not out of line.
How about just transit system pension plans?
So transit system varies, okay? So we did take a look at, let's say, about five different transit systems, and you're better funded than most of those except for the Metropolitan Transit Authority, New York.
Okay? But the question, and I always keep going, it's not how we are compared to everybody else. Is everybody else going under and we're going under with them? I mean, is this, the District of Columbia is 101% funded, okay? We're completely funded. So Chicago is what? What's Chicago funded at? 50?
It's less than 60.
So it's less than 60. All right, and so we're at 70. So we're closer to Chicago than we are to the District of Columbia. So is that good? Is it bad? Is it a problem? Is it a problem today? Not today, but it's going to be 5 years from now or 10 years from now? I mean, this is what I need to understand. I know in the District of Columbia, we had a $2.5 billion unfunded pension liability in 1976.
Okay.
By 1991, we had run it up to $10 billion.
Okay.
And we were going under. Okay. There was nothing we could do about it. Is that what we're looking at here?
It doesn't feel that way simply because you have been making ongoing contributions, which are not just funding the cost of benefits that are accruing, but also bringing down that unfunded liability. So, I mean, unless if you're looking at it, like if you're looking at an imminent sort of shutdown of the organization, yes, it's a problem because you have, you know, a lot of money on the books that's not been funded yet. But you feel you have been, and perhaps. You know, you can speak better to what you've been putting in terms of contributions, but you have been paying more than just what the benefits that are accruing. So it feels like you have been ratcheting down that unfunded. Okay. And like I said, the unfunded level doesn't seem completely out of line compared to the 100 largest public plans that I looked at.
All right. Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I think some of those places like Chicago, Detroit, well below 70,
yes,
headed towards zero. And I don't think we've been headed in that direction.
Yeah.
But you could sleep better at night if the number were a little higher.
Thank you. I know Kathy had her hand up as well. So question for you, is there any reason to for us to put additional funding into it today, or what would be the benefit of doing so?
You eventually, as I said, would have to pay this benefit, right, this money. So putting money into the plan is not wasted money. It's covering the obligations. It would secure the benefits better as well, should you be able to put the money in. So.
Right, but as an analyst, is there a reason to do it? Why would you put additional money in today? If there was a lack of confidence that you'd be able to fund it in the future, would you put more in today? Is there a fear of being able to cover that payment in the future, or are we at adequate reserves today? As long as we assume continued constant contributions.
So if I may point you to, if you look at the actual determined employer contribution section, and you look at the second line there, payment of amortization of unfunded liability, in a way you have a systematic process that's already set up, as I said, to fund this unfunded liability. So that's already there, and so you're already doing that. Now, if you had, it depends on the decision of whether you had additional cash, this money is going to have to be paid into this plan, assuming you want to fund these benefits and meet the obligations that WMATA has.
Would you compare this to a consumer paying off their mortgage early? Jack, you were asking for an example there. I have 30 years of debt that I know that I'm going to have to pay $1,000 a month. And if I paid an extra $100 a month, I might knock 10 years off of my obligation.
Yeah. Is that more flexibility what to do with the plan when it's better funded, right? As well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you want to go overfunded, and I don't think you want to need. Did you want to make a comment?
Yes. If I could, I mean, you know, from my perspective, it's in effect deferred maintenance.
Yep.
You know, you've got it coming.
Yep.
It's going to cost you more the more you delay getting to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Over time. That's from simple way of thinking about it.
And it's also the case, if you make the contribution, you'll be generating the earnings over time to bring you up to the amounts you're going to have to pay.
Sorry, Mort. Kathy, you're...
I was going into the same place that Mr. Cochran was going, and that is, what is it in an organization do we look to determine whether or not it's 100%, it's 90%, it's whatever, because of the structure of the organization, its ability to pay the other things. I think to the general manager's point, if you are deferring everything, not only your pension, then yes, you might need to be 100%. The question, and I think what would be helpful is that we kind of hear some, I asked a question of industry standards, but not necessarily industry, but an opportunity to arrive at this decision as to whether it should be 100% or whether it should be enough to give us the ability to reach the obligation that we will have every year. Through what methods? And that is the question that's there.
Right. So from an industry standard perspective, as I said, I shared with you sort of the statistics of what's happening with the transit systems as well as what's happening with the largest public plans, right? With the largest 100 public plans, you're well in line. So everybody's funding according and then going about funding because they have a going concern organization and they feel like they can put the money in and they're using their dollars partly to fund their pension plan as partly as needed for their organization as well, right? And so that's not out of line. I guess there's probably a broader picture perhaps that I'm not seeing, but if I were just looking at just this thing, right, and it doesn't seem like you're out of line in the way you're funded and what you're doing to go forward. If you shut down contributions in the future, yes, that could be a problem.
How does, and this is not really for you as much as it is for Mr. Anasecki, this where we are right now and our funded ratio, how does this have an impact on, as we're going to talk about later today, our ability to raise money, the cost of that money? Does it have an impact? And as he's saying that, how does it relate to our larger overall financial picture?
Thank you, Mr. Gerstein. It does impact the capital market reaction to your ability to issue debt. And so part of what you're going to see today is a delineation of these liabilities in the preliminary official statements and ultimately in the official statements so that the potential bondholders, folks that are thinking about buying your debt, are fully informed about your outstanding obligations and therefore your capacity to repay them. Obviously, if there are no debts out there, you're in a better position to issue debt at better rates than if you have these kinds of obligations.
If I understand it, just what makes this a little bit more complicated is that the unfunded obligation isn't a set number. It changes over time. It's based on current assumptions about interest rates and market performance and whatever else we have investments in. I remember we had a discussion, some years back, that we had a much smaller unfunded liability because of assumptions being made at that time about market performance and things like that. And there's no assumption that this number is going to stay steady. If interest rates go up, for example, it's likely to shrink. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so not only do we have numbers here that we're looking at that there's a gap, but that those goalposts are going to change over time. The gap is going to get bigger or smaller, regardless of what we do, just because a large part of the money that's in these pension funds is, in fact, investment earnings and not contributions. If I remember going back many years, if you look at your normal pension fund, the bulk of the money is, in fact, earnings, not contributions. Is that correct?
65% of the growth in pension funds is usually earnings.
Right. And so your assumptions about earnings are really, really key and critical to assuming how much you'll need and what your investments are going to do. And so as those change over time, that means that your unfunded liability is going to get bigger and smaller, even if you don't change your contribution rate at all. I'm just not to make it too simple, just to make sure we complicate it.
Yeah, just another couple of simple observations. If we were to wish to increase that ratio, this will require annual contributions that will compete with everything else in the budget, fair subsidy levels and the like. So it's an important call.
And labor.
And labor, yeah. Two other thoughts. In terms of the capital markets, in some of the meltdowns we've seen recently, the end game has been who gets paid, the bondholders or the pensioners? And I think over time there's going to be a lot more attention to the ability to pay the pensioners because in some cases they've come in ahead of the bondholders. And the third observation, $1 billion unfunded in the pension system is smaller than our unfunded liability for retiree health care towards which we have no funding. I think the scope of this committee ought to be looking at that as well.
I don't want to get into the OPEB issue, Mr. Chairman,
but I think eventually
today,
right.
But I certainly understand that on the health for retiree health issues. That's a whole other nut to crack.
So
as we're winding down here, and I know we have a lot of meetings today, what I'd like to do is, with your help of the members, what we'd like to do. Let me just throw out a couple ideas that we've talked to Dennis about. One is that, let's go back to the beginning. All the questions that we're asking, Mr. Chairman, that as if we're the trustees. We're not the trustees. All right. We're the plan sponsor. So the questions that I would have is for this subcommittee is to ask the chairman or chairperson of the trustees to come before this committee and talk about their investment strategies, their valuation estimates, Kathy's questions about performance in the marketplace, whether they're indexed, whether how they're handling their investment consultants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Even to include, are they going and getting educated about what's going on in the marketplace through conferences or most of which are free.
by the way. And I don't know whether the committee wants to do that, and it's I don't know how to do that, quite frankly. Do we send a letter to 689 or one at local 922 and invite them? And I was thinking of doing this on a quarterly basis rather than a monthly basis, but I'd throw that out as a food for thought. What does the committee think about that idea?
Yes.
Okay, Tony. Malcolm? Kathy?
Quarterly.
Jack, since you're here today, is
that makes sense? I think it's great. No, yes, yeah. Just tell them to come. Don't even ask them. Just tell them to be here.
Well, yeah. I think it'd be good to know who they are. Okay, yeah, now, we know who the management appointees are to the trustees, but I don't know who the other trustees are. Yes, sure, go ahead.
Right, we can ask from Kevin.
I'd like it to be, as you said, Kathy, positive. How can we help them? Let me get to the bottom line here as we run. We're going to get a number to plug into these pension for our – and, Dennis, I need you to talk about this for a minute. Out of the blue comes a number and from the actuaries, right? You have to plug into the budget. Okay. And I've been on the board here for a while. I don't know how this number, you know, just drops in out of thin air. And I don't think any of my fellow board members, more you were chairman for a while, you know, that we ever even discussed the number, how it was derived, you know, what was it, you know, scrubbed, was it, you know, validated, was it accurate with per the previous year, and I feel very uncomfortable being approving budgets around here when we don't know how this number even got aligned. Right. But Dennis, could you just speak to that for a second?
Right. The number that we get every year is a derivative of the analysis that they've spoken of. Once the actual analysis is done, it will give you both the normal cost and as well as the cost that you need to catch up in respect to your unfunded, and we will get that directly from the pension plan. The difficulty that we have is the timing of those receipts and how we build the budget. So in some cases it's higher, in some cases it's lower. So we have to go through the internal adjustments to make sure that we respect the request. And so we are talking to HR in terms of, you know, how to formalize that process to make sure we're conducting that review. But ultimately, we are compelled to accept whatever the pension plans give us.
All right. So maybe the committee, just for food for thought here, we should have that meeting about the number that we're going to have to plug into the budget be our next meeting of the subcommittee. I mean, is that versus my alternative idea about asking the trustees to come, because I think we're in budget mode right now. My colleagues have any thought about that? Because this number is going to drop right into the budget, and I don't know.
It already has. We've approved the budget.
What?
We approved the budget last month.
Yeah. That's
hoping. Well, we haven't done the operating budget.
Yeah, we
did. I mean the capital budget.
Operating.
All right, so Dennis, what did you, all right, since my colleagues, so you had to plug a number in, right? Okay, so what did you plug in? I mean, I'm sorry I was behind the curve a little bit on that.
It's essentially the numbers that you saw here today is the numbers that are in the budget for next year.
Chairman.
Okay,
so then we're back to the original idea about having the trustees to come in and talk to us about how they how they're doing. Okay, Kathy.
Yeah. Chairman. Go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to emphasize that point because I think I think the purpose of starting this subcommittee is to find out how do we want to move forward with this. And I think that we are past the 2017 budget. We are on the next step. And if we want to be able to reflect upon the relationship of what they bring to the finance director, that gives us in the right place.
Chairman, I think another thing we need to be looking at is what are the trends and what are others doing? I know around the country pension funds are being pushed to lower their expectations on earnings. We're now having one of our key fund is assuming they'll make 8% almost. Our key fund, our largest fund, is assuming 7.85% earnings. I wish I could assume that for my portfolio.
I noticed that too.
Right. But of course, like CalPERS is going down into the sixes. A lot of concern that we've over-anticipated earnings, and I think we should be understanding what others are doing in order to be sure that we're not fooling ourselves mm-hmm. about where the plans are going.
I agree. So, sorry, Kat. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, sorry. The only comment I would, I think you made a great point, and that's what I was going to say, that I think that when you have those meetings, one of the key questions that you want to ask as a committee is, how's this rate set? And how do we, what kind of investment, to achieve a 7.85% investment, you know,
yeah.
I looked at sort of the distribution, and if I'm not mistaken, it was roughly about 65, 68% in equities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fairly, you know, if you're maybe, you might be perfectly comfortable with that, or you may not be. And so I think from a questioning perspective, again, I'm not saying it's the wrong assumption,
sure.
just to understand how that can be achieved.
Good point. Kath, you're okay? All right, so what I'll do, Leif, how you doing over there?
Just two quick questions. I'm glad you got to the last slide, which I think has, you know, some of the most important components. So we discussed the investment return rate. Can you just speak a little bit to the mortality table and the difference between private plans and public plans, and then maybe a recommendation on the optimal term for the smoothing period, because we have variance with the different plans. The optimal period for the smoothing duration, because we've got different durations for different plans.
In the assets, you mean?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, so let me actually first of all speak to the real quick on the mortality table. What you're using right now, the RP2000, is what's being used for private plan funding, but however, they're all using fully generational means reflecting all the longevity improvements. In Local 689, you're just partially reflecting that because you're only doing it to the valuation date. So you're a little bit behind. If you could go to the next slide, you'll see on the bottom left-hand corner there. But as I've mentioned, the Society of Actuaries has now released a new table reflecting much more current mortality improvements and longevity, which we expect in private plans. It's called the RP2014, and we expect that to be put into the valuation of private plans, if not in 2017, most definitely in 2018. And that's going to jump up the liabilities by anywhere from 5 to 7%. Okay? Public plans, I think most of them are using the RP2000, so you're not off base, except for the longevity improvement. Right? So that's probably something you need to keep in mind, that the liabilities will jump. It's a great question. Probably another 3 to 5% when those new mortality tables come in, possibly. I think then you had asked the question about, the smoothing of the assets. You know, for the most part, you're using a five-year smoothing for the larger plans. So 3 to 5 years is not unreasonable. That's about the right range. The 10-year is a bit long, but then the plan is really small as well. So I didn't worry about that. There's only one plan, the Transit Police, which is a much smaller plan. Yeah, but a five-year smoothing is not unusual. In the private sector, the maximum smoothing for point of reference is 2 years. That's all that's allowed under ERISA, but you're not subject to ERISA. Okay. So, but before that, 5 years was the norm. Okay. Does that help?
Respect to more smoothing. Again, what's happening in a lot of places is infinite smoothing.
Is what?
Infinite. As you look at it for 3 years, but then you look at it again, you're always pushing out into the future. I'm not sure what we're doing, but that's a concern as well.
Yeah, I didn't know about that. Okay, so we're almost to the end of our scheduled time, and I know the chairman likes to keep us on a tight schedule.